Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
I walk along the city streets you used to walk along with me. Every step I take recalls how much in love we used to be. Oh, how can I forget you when there is always something there to remind me?
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, my partners in crime, we have Michael Snydell.
Good evening.
Hello. And we also have Bill Graham.
Woo!
Yeah. So we are here today to talk about I'm just gonna, you know, before I even say that, I am recovering from some kind of illness this weekend. So I am going to trip over my words more often than usual. I may break down into a coughing fit. I may generally appear to be drunk, but I am not.
Are we sure you're not a replicant?
It's possible. I mean, do replicants get, like, head colds and chest coughs and stuff like that?
I wish I had written down some of the tests that they give Gosling's character.
The baseline thing?
Yeah.
A mother holding its child, cell. Yeah. Anyway, let's
try. I don't know, guys. That's not in the first 5 minutes. That might be spoiled.
Oh my God! Someone talks to him. It's gonna be. We're gonna kick it off by saying we are talking about Blade Runner 2049, directed by our boy Denis Villeneuve, and it is also starring Ryan Gosling. This is already going poorly for me. It's a movie that is out in theaters. It is a sequel to Blade Runner, obviously. The spoiler section and the non-spoiler section are gonna get, the line is gonna be thin. It's gonna be as thin as a razor blade? I don't know. So we'll do our best to
run with it.
Statements. Yeah, we're gonna run with it. At 2049, we will go into full spoilers. That would actually be super cool, but we're not going to do that.
No.
What, 20 minutes and 49 seconds?
Yeah.
That's doable. We can hit that mark.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Maybe. Anyway, so what are we doing? We're talking about Blade Runner 2049, Denis Villeneuve, Ryan Gosling, numerous other actors and actresses of all stripes. Before we get into that, maybe we'll talk very quickly about some news that happened, just because it's on the lips and the minds of the populace. And, that's that. So, usual basic stuff, twitter.com/filmstageshow, Facebook, look for The Film Stage Show, email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com, iTunes, give us a comment, give us a rating, and, that's pretty much it. Go to Patreon and help support this show. We, in the last weeks, have been having some issues starting on time because my headphones have begun to die. And with your support, maybe I can get some headphones that won't die randomly and will actually start. It's like right now they're like a weird car that like has trouble starting when you first turn the key. It seems like they have to be plugged in for like 5 minutes before they're finally like, what? What? And then they start doing their job. So again, patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. Help support us. For as little as $1 an episode, you get access to our super cool Slack channel. And you will also be put into the running for DVD the Blu-rays that we are giving out. So that is awesome. So get on there and you will be automatically entered. All of our subscribers and patrons are automatically entered to win those great, great, great cinema classics. Oh boy. I should have done some cocaine before I got on here, or at least had a Red Bull.
You don't do that every time?
Those are the exact same thing.
Huh. Usually, cocaine.
One is the generic version.
Oh yes. As we all know, cocaine is generic Red Bull. usually before we podcast, I just have like a small meal so that I'm not like laden down. I'm not in like a burrito coma, and I'm able to articulate my thoughts with finesse and ease. But anyway, before we get into everything, we are brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. You could get a free 30-day subscription to Mubi by going to mubi.com/filmstage. Mubi has 30 films available at any time. Each day, they introduce a new film onto their streaming platform, and you have 30 days to watch. During that period, you can download it so you can watch it on the go, or you can use any of their wonderful apps for your smart TV, mobile device, PC, laptop. It's October, so Mubi is doing some cool shit, really getting some good horror films on there. They already had some John Carpenter earlier, which was not in October, but now you can see the original Night of the Living Dead. Woo! A movie that, if you've never looked it up, has a fascinating backstory, because after they cut it, they forgot to put the copyright like thing at the start, and that is why like anyone can play it, display it, do a fan edit or whatever, because it's technically owned by no one.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. Wow.
It's super weird.
There's also some Cronenberg on there, and Claire Denis, I guess one of her only horror films, Trouble Every Day.
Yeah.
So I'd recommend that one too.
So there's some, like I said, some great, great stuff coming to the movie stage. All you
Trouble
have
Every
do...
Day has the fun distinction of having intro credits in.
Wait, it has the fun distinction of what?
Of having the intro credits in Comic Sans.
Oh my god, that truly is terrifying. Also coming, we have David Cronenberg's Rabid, which we had talked about, and we also have Angst, which is an infamous Austrian horror film. So check it out. It's the perfect time for all of our horror hounds out there to get their eyes on some of the greats that you may not be able to see easily elsewhere. So that is Mubi, mubi.com/filmstage. And so that's that for that. Now we can get into the meat of the episode. So let's dive right in to our review of the feature film that we are talking about today. That is Blade Runner 2049, the newest film from Denis Villeneuve. And it stars a bevy of great actors and actresses. We got Ryan Gosling, Robin Wright, and no reason not to say it, Harrison Ford. Here is the trailer.
Every civilization was built off the back of a disposable workforce. But I can only make so many. Happy birthday.
There is an order to things. That's what we do here. We keep order. The world is built on a wall that separates kind. Tell either side there's no wall, you bought a war.
Alright, that is the trailer for Blade Runner 2049. As we stated earlier, this is going to be a difficult review because critics who went to screenings and were writing reviews were actually given like a little list of things that they were asked not to talk about. Now that the movie's out, we don't technically have to abide by that list, but for the joy and the watching experience of our many fans, we're gonna peel the onion back in layers. So first, as is often the case now, I don't know, we feel like we've been doing this more often now. We're going to give our one word yes or no whether people should see this movie. Then we're going to give as few spoilers as possible to give our general thoughts. And then we're going to do a full spoiler section where we can really, really dive right in. So kick it off. One word recommendation. Bill Graham, what do you think of Blade Runner 2049? Should people check it out?
Absolutely.
All right. Michael Snydell.
Sure.
All right, and I say absolutely as well, I guess. But that's actually
I was going to say coffee, but yeah.
All right. All of us are to varying degrees telling you that you should see Blade Runner 2049. So if that's all you're here for, you got it. Go out and see it. Now let's have our general thoughts with as few spoilers as possible. I think that that shouldn't be too hard. There is actually a lot to talk about this film, aside from the plot. So let's start with Bill Graham. What were your basic thoughts on Blade Runner 2049?
So a couple of quick adjectives, I guess, should suffice, at least from the outset. This movie is big. It is pretentious. It is arty. It is long as hell. It is overlong. It is dark. It is brooding. It is at times stupefyingly obvious, and at other times glaringly mysterious for no other reason than to be mysterious. I think it enhances and explores the world that Ridley Scott kind of created in the original Blade Runner, and it almost manages to one-up it in a lot of different ways. It is extremely well acted, and I just enjoyed every moment of this film, and I'm curious how the rewatch of this will feel. It is it is something to behold that Roger Deakins has not won an Oscar yet, and this should absolutely be his first. I'm just stunned that this movie actually exists, because it costs a reported $150 million, and it is like not what I was expecting from a big action blockbuster film, much the same way that the original Blade Runner is kind of plotting and a little bit more self-serious than an action film typically, you know, you would expect. So yeah, I really enjoyed this, and I'm curious to see how differently people kind of interpret this film and take it and either just completely slog it or praise it to the high heavens, because I've already listened to a couple of different podcasts doing one of those two things. So it's interesting.
All right. Michael Snydell.
I didn't particularly like this one, but I honestly think this might be more. I definitely have some overall like problems with this film, but I think this is honestly more preference about what Villeneuve's sensibility is, how he chooses to tell this story. I'll say right up front. I know that some people will. May disregard my opinion after this now, but even the original Blade Runner is a film I more admire than really like. It's something I think, like, from a production design standpoint, from a cinematography standpoint, I mean, I think it's nearly peerless. But like, Ridley Scott has always been a director that's been kind of difficult for me in the sense that, like, building way more than character building, and that's just always been a weird thing for me.
As was seen in Alien Covenant.
Sure.
Oh, Jesus.
Blade Runner 2049 is I guess aesthetically you get incredible, and that's a weird way to put it. Like, from frame to frame, it's like often breathtaking to me, just the way that Deakins and Villeneuve and I don't have the set designer name in front of me, but just the way that things, you know, compared to the kind of like, you know, grimy luster of the original, this one, you know, feels like so aggressively designed. In a way that, like, at once feels like really mathematical to me, but also like really like this like planned imperfection. And so it's like it really is incredible just the way that like shadows dance on the wall and stuff. Yeah, but
you had said the production designer is Dennis Gassner.
Oh, thank you. Well, he definitely deserves credit because, yeah, every scene here is just kind of insanely detailed.
Yeah, and the supervising art director is Paul Inglis.
Okay, excellent.
So, shout outs.
Yeah, so and this is in contrast to the original, is definitely interested more in character. I'd say even to its detriment, but again, I think that's a lot more preference than real problems. In the sense of like, I think it's very interesting that, so I rewatched Blade Runner, the Final Cut, literally hours before I saw 2049. And it's interesting. I mean, despite all of the easy punchlines, you know, about the new one being 45 minutes longer than the original, it really is fascinating to see the ways that both of them kind of elongate a thin archetypal story, which I don't mean thin as a insult at all. I literally think that it is very much what it means to be, same as what this does. But from the pacing to hold on, I'm trying to think of a way to not make this in any way spoilery. Villeneuve's,
we're all just gonna pronounce his name a different way, aren't we?
Yeah, I guess we are. Yeah. His let me say this, his scattered interests. And I will be more clear what I mean there. I just found that I wasn't really engaged or interested with that many things that he was eventually delving into, especially he revealed what he was actually after. And so, like, I mean, sci-fi is already something that's kind of hard for me to really engage with. So, like, take my opinion with a massive grain of salt with this one, for sure. But, yeah, this just didn't really do that much for me, which is kind of bizarre. And my more specific issues definitely need to be discussed in spoilers. I understand why people love this. It's an ambitious, did I say gorgeous? It's a gorgeous movie. And
say gorgeous again. Deakins isn't going to win the Oscar, obviously, so we should feel free to give him as much credit as we want. Right now.
I guess it's kind of well acted and sophisticated. I mean, other than someone who I hope we have a conversation about, because every time he was on screen, I wanted to die.
I hope it's Ryan Gosling. That would be hilarious.
It's definitely Ryan Gosling. He's just, you know, not in the movie at all. I'm a little bit at a loss of why this didn't engage me, but I can't really call it boring. I can't say that it didn't do what it wanted to do. It's just ultimately what it wanted to do, I thought, kind of lacked imagination or was really interested in delving into the things I wanted it to delve into. And I mean, the last thing I'll say is, man, Villeneuve really, really likes movies about memory.
Yes.
And it's getting to be a little bit of a one trick pony for me.
Interesting. I will immediately rebut your point by saying I think that every film that he has made about memory or experience has viewed it from a different direction, and thus I'm on board. I don't mind people who have pet themes as long as they don't keep stating the same thing over and over about them, and I don't believe that is what he does here. So, yeah, screw you, Michael. What? I don't even know what more I can say. The movie is absolutely gorgeous. Throw that out there. Easy. What's the word I'm looking for? It's a super easy accolade to give. We all know that I love a good movie about cons. We can add to that we know I love a movie about a dye pack that explodes when someone robs a bank. I think I've also mentioned that I love film noir. I love a good detective
Bodies
story.
Bodies in Trunk?
Bodies and trunks are pretty good. If you could get a body in a trunk, and then like maybe the body has a dye pack, and this is all part of an elaborate con, I'd think that that would be the best movie ever made. Now thinking about that, and I will write that movie
three more times.
Yeah. Well, never mind. We're not getting into this. I have found that I have a tendency to start writing movies off the top of my head if I am not stopped, and so I will stop myself before I do that. So what I was going to say is, wrapped up in the con movie is the noir detective novel and attendant films. I love me some Dashiell Hammett, love me some Raymond Chandler. And so I was super happy with how much of a film noir this movie was. Obviously, it takes place in L.A. You got your lone cop with your corrupt institutions and your femmes fatale. And I think that's grammatically the way that that is constructed.
Femme fatales?
I think it's femmes fatale because it's a dangerous woman.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's your women who are dangerous, your femmes fatale.
All right, Brent.
Yeah, anyway, I'll just barrel ahead, assuming I'm correct. So, like any good
woman
should.
Nobody's
going
to stop you.
So that was great. I loved it. I love
it. You are right. It can be either, but you are right.
Oh, right. So that's cool. We could basically end the podcast now. I'm just going to take that sound clip of Michael saying, "You are right," and just loop it constantly.
Oh, wait, you're wrong. You're wrong. It's femmes fatales. You're wrong.
It's femmes fatales?
Yep, femmes fatales or femme fatales.
Interesting.
This just sounds like stupid talk now.
And it's not that French thing where like they don't pronounce the final S. Let's move on. So Ryan Gosling as the stoic detective who has to navigate, I'm just going to say it in English, dangerous women and corrupt government contraptions. And basically the thing that I love most about this particular genre, just keep getting beaten until he finds the truth. Is great for me. I think that even if this movie weren't shot and acted and realized to the degree it is, I would be held in place by the story that it was telling. Now, that's just, you know, my way of saying that everything else is not icing on a cake because it's so integral. There's no food metaphor good enough. It's like you had a really good meal inside of another meal, but in reality, that shit is disgusting. So to see a story this tight told with this much care everywhere else, and to not have it be subjugated by the budget, like to finally see a movie where they didn't say, "We have flying cars and explosions, why do we need a story?" is utterly like energizing for me. And so I was sitting there in rapt attention, even as the people behind me could not stop saying out loud, really loudly, "I thought this was an action movie. Why is there so much slow walking?" And then there was a point during a pivotal scene where two characters are talking where this asshole behind me kept trying to guess what the next line of dialogue was, and he was always wrong. So it's not even like when I was watching Snakes on a Plane and I turned to my brother and said, out loud, "Because if you die, all of this was for nothing." And then Samuel L. Jackson said it. And so people around me laughed. Like, that's the kind of asshole talking out loud in the theater you can at least get behind. But in this,
so you're
he was
finishing
like,
each other's sandwiches?
Yeah, we totally finished. I could finish a movie's sandwiches sometimes. Like, that is an ability I have. But this guy, so I just wanted to turn around and say, "You're not being funny. You're not being clever. What are you doing?" And so finally, at the end of the movie, I turned around to him and I said to him and his girlfriend, "Will you two please shut the fuck up? You've been doing that all movie. It's annoying as shit and it's almost over." And they finally shut the fuck up. And so, but like, this is, I think what I'm getting at with this movie had a low grossing weekend. My hope is that the good reviews and good word of mouth will buoy it and it will have some legs, and that we will actually, for once, award a thoughtful science fiction film that's told on a big budget scale. But my concern is that the assholes behind me are indicative of the wider movie-going audience, and that people are just gonna suck, and they're not gonna watch this movie correctly. Like, they're gonna be brought in the wrong way, and they're not gonna have the patience for it, and they're not gonna, like, allow themselves to get swept up. I need to cough. One moment. they're not going to let themselves get swept up in this super interesting world that was created. Like, even if you don't like the mystery, there's so many things about this movie that are great. And I can't even talk about most of them because they involve spoilers. But they are the types of things that make you question very fundamental things in new ways. And it's just annoying that, like, these pricks behind me were so wrapped up in wondering why there wasn't more shooting and explosions that they couldn't even appreciate that. It's like they were given a flawless, like, steak with pommes frites, and then they were pissed off that they didn't get any ketchup. And it's like, maybe if you just chew what's in front of you, you'll find the flavors that you came looking for in new and unexpected places, you goddamn idiots. And saw this movie with, like, a head cold or something only made it worse, because I was like, if I am putting the effort in and I am getting so much from it, you two healthy people could do the same.
Brian, that elitism's a little dangerous. I recognize that you and Bill love it, but, like, don't. I will agree. Trying to guess the next line is, yeah, that'd be pretty low on my tolerance list,
yeah,
as well.
It's not, but, that kind, like, of movie. But the other thing is, like, I sat through Cloud Atlas, and I didn't say a word. Like, I sat
this
through
is,
The Hobbit
this is just,
and didn't
this is
say
movie,
a word. Like, just
yeah, this
shut
is movie
the fuck
going.
Up.
Yeah, it's movie going 101, but I think one of the things that you're kind of touching on a little bit, and Michael's kind of trying to back away from it a little bit, we've had this interesting discussion going on in our own Slack channel with our Patreon members about their own goings-ons with, like, interacting with people that interact with movies, and a couple of them either currently or used to work at some movie
video stores,
and they just tell horror stories of, like, people just returning movies that are either in a foreign language or are slow and being like, this movie made me think, I didn't like it.
What's
and it's just like, what is wrong with these people? But here's the bigger thing for you, Brian, that I kind of keep running into with a lot of general movie going populist, which blows my fucking mind, is if they had sat down and actually watched Blade Runner, they would know what to expect from Blade
Sure.
Runner 2049. They would not be pissed off that this 2.5 hour movie was slow. And it's,
well,
like,
what's also crazy is that I don't feel like the trailers gave the impression that this was an action movie.
I don't know. Like, I don't know. I'm going, like, to fight back about that one a little bit.
Brian, it's big. It's flashy. It's pretty. It's
but
got
see,
Ryan Gosling in it. It's got Harrison Ford in it. And it's got guns. Like, people are just going to look at that and just be like, oh, so it's going to be 2.5 hours of that.
Because everyone, like, went to The Courageous Heart expecting Harrison Ford to do something. Is that the movie? The one where he's
a
doctor?
Hard sci-fi. Like,
my concern in that way is, so people have basically been force-fed to a point where they see a big scale, star-studded, like, effects heavy movie and immediately think, oh, action, like the Avengers. Like, that's what we've done to people. Like,
I mean, yes, but that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with those people.
I think it means there's something wrong with those people.
No, it doesn't. If you are going to – come on. I want to step out of this a little bit. Like, sometimes I love to get on this pulpit as well. But, like, you got to think that if you're going to, you know, one movie every 3 months at, you know, or even – less frequently than that, like, and you go to this, it is, there are going to be some people who are going to react to it and be like, what the fuck is this?
Well, so,
like,
but here's my see,
but like, wait, Brian, just real quick, like,
yeah,
I guess what I'm saying is that, like, there are people who are going to expect this to be like Avengers, and to be fair, Bill is absolutely right. If you've seen Blade Runner, you kind of know you're going to be in for this kind of, like, languid pace. But if you're not, like, I don't hold it against those people until they actually obviously ruin my experience.
Yeah, then it exactly.
Yes.
And that's, when, that's my, when, like, if they had walked out of the movie saying, like, man, that sucked. You know what? More power to you. I don't give a shit what you thought of the movie, unless you're speaking it into my ear. And the other problem is, and this is kind of what I was going to, is that I want to sit in this movie theater and watch this movie in the dark, in silence, next to my wife, and just enjoy it. And, like, I'm one of the people, I want to see movies in theaters, but, like, these people are actively making me think, oh man, like, is this a movie that's going to make some asshole behind me talk about how slow it is because he didn't know what he was getting into? Maybe I should wait for, like, home video so I can watch it in my house, petting my dog, sitting next to my wife still. And, like maybe that's what I should do, because I don't want the idiots of the world to ruin this for me. And so in that way, I will let them win and the theatrical experience will die. Like, so that,
it's weird that you even have to think about that.
It is. It's terrible. Cause like I said, if they'd walked out, like if the end credits had come up and the guy had blown a raspberry, like that would be more acceptable than his fucking nonsense during the film. The worst part is that he said, oh, I'm sorry, bro. And like meant it. He was legitimately sorry. Like he didn't know what
surprised.
He was doing. So there's that. But I will say that, like, so that was all my way of saying, I don't think this movie is too intelligent for any audience. I don't. I think that it's a well-paced, interesting, like every frame tells a story. And in terms
right,
of the world,
you already said you're in the tank for this a little bit. Like,
because it's a genre that I love course. From a director that I just want to say this. I never talk during you guys talking about your general thoughts.
All right. I'm sorry.
And my
sorry.
Thoughts always turn into our actual discussion. So
I'm
I will
sorry.
Say that to me, Michael, in my tank with this movie, it's a genre that I love with a director that I love that with an actor who I think when cast appropriately could be a very compelling on-screen presence. And I think that it sets up a world that is more tactile and more generally interesting frame by frame and scene by scene than anything that like we're seeing in Star Wars or Marvel's The Avengers. I think that there's more thought put into like a glass in this movie than people put into to like the starships in the Star Wars films. And I think that part of this movie's appeal to me is the fact that it doesn't do what like the Star Wars prequels did. It didn't take modern technology and just assume that that was where it was going. It actually seemed to grow organically from the previous Blade Runner. Obviously, it's 30 years into the future of that narrative timeline, but in general, it kept like a lot of the analog approaches. It gave some modern technology to them via us, but in general, it was just really well made and really well thought out. And so I want a movie like this that obviously has so much care and attention put into details big and small to succeed. And I hope that it does down the line. All right, Michael.
No, I
was in the tank fair. For this movie. Is that a problem?
No, it's not a problem. This is getting into semantics and it's unnecessary. And you're right that I interrupted your opinion. So I'm sorry. I would like to actually get into.
So do you just think I should be more open about like maybe not everyone will love this, but if you're like me and you love film noir and like more grounded, grounded, like forward looking futurism rather than fantastical sci-fi that like you're probably going to like it more than someone who does just want the next Avengers.
I mean, yes. I mean, it's not only just your natural interest in sci-fi and noir. I think there is just something to be said that even more so than, you know, like the last like really smart blockbuster I can think of, like Mad Max Fury Road. Like yeah. I would say that's a weird comparison, obviously. But my point being
it's one I've
that,
seen being made a lot, though. So you're on point there.
Okay, but that being a far more visceral experience that someone might take to. I'm just saying that I can see someone, if they didn't do their research, like expecting this to be a very different movie than what they got.
Yeah.
Which is partly their problem, but I'm just saying.
Exactly.
I think it's easy to say that oh, everyone should be able to take to this interesting story. And like, yes, I see where you're coming from there. But I also think that there are expectations related to attention spans, related to what regular multiplex stuff is, and related to what Blade Runner is, which is not a super easy film for, you know, someone who... See, I don't even want to get into that because I don't want to say that Blade Runner. One's capable of it. Yeah. I'm just saying that they're not films that spoon feed you. They're based on a lot of suggestion, which is fine. But I'm just saying, for a lot of people, if you're not in for that,
I think one of the most interesting things about this film that if you do any kind of research is it almost is appalling to try and be someone that has not seen the original and get amped up and see this big, beautiful film coming down the line and be like, oh, cool, I'm going to start to engage with this. And let me go rent Blade Runner, the original film. Wait, how many fucking versions are there? Wait, which one should I feel bad because there are five versions of this fucking film out there in Blu-ray high definition that you can legitimately watch and have an experience with, and then go to someone else and they would immediately be like, oh, cool, you saw the original? What cut did you see? And you just be like, that's a barrier, the first one?
This one is
– it's like, I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry this movie is so fucked from the get-go that like a lot of people are just going to be like, yeah, no, I'm just going to go see the new one.
Well, my wife had not seen the original Blade Runner, and I've only ever seen the – not the final cut. I don't even know which version I saw,
directors,
in all honesty.
Or work
probably
prints.
The directors.
Did it have voiceover?
No.
Okay. Then you saw
it's
one of
directors.
The
directors.
Yeah, I saw the director's cut, and that was like a while ago. And so like I went in without the firmest grasp of all the details of the plot of the first one, but like we both really loved it. And she's not a big detective story person, but she said today, like, you know, the story's a little like thin, but mm-hmm. she loved, like me, she also loved.
Yeah, she tweeted me.
Oh, nice. I didn't know that. Should we jump into spoilers? I feel like we've gone
absolutely
round and round. We've complained about shitty people in theaters, which is becoming a weekly segment.
Oh boy!
Yeah, I know. I'm not happy about
what a year for Robin Wright.
What else has she been in?
She was in Wonder Woman.
Oh, she was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is. You know, I'll get up on board that. What a year for Robin Wright. So let's talk spoilers for Blade Runner. Here's your grace period of like 10 seconds while I cough to get out of here if you haven't seen it.
Here's something that I'll just go ahead and mention. See this in the loudest theater possible, because the score, even though it does not have Johansson, and he apparently signed a non-disclosure agreement about him like walking away from the film, so I'm not quite sure what's going on there. Whatever is going on here, I'm and I want 5 hours of it. Like, put it in my ears. I love it so much, and it reminds me a lot of the synth stuff that was going on in the original Blade Runner, and I'm just all about it. Like, holy shit! Not since Tron Legacy have I had just like the visual and the audio just be like, I don't even care what this movie is doing, like just keep me here.
All right, so let's get into spoilers now that Bill has given us that. What was I gonna say? I guess I should just let's rip some band-aids off. So the main character played by Ryan Gosling is
Han dies.
Han dies.
Jesus.
That's your go-to spoiler.
Wow.
Oh, you know what's fucking hilarious? Wow. I thought you meant Han from Fast and Furious.
I know. I thought that too. And then I thought about it a little bit more and I was like, no, that's too vague of a reference for him. And I was
like, that's what I loved about it. I was like, yeah, Han does die, but that's not really a spoiler because it happens in
Tokyo Drift.
Oh, shit.
I hope we spoil that. I hope we spoil
two things. We spoil two things for everybody.
Your name is Han in a movie. Odds are you're going to die. So Kay,
sorry, listeners.
Ryan Gosling's character Kay is a replicant. He is a new, more obedient breed of replicant. He opens the movie by retiring Sapper Morton, played by Dave Bautista, and discovering a burial site on his property. The bones found in that burial site belong to a woman who had a baby, but the bones also have the mark of a replicant. So that means that a replicant gave birth, which is a bad thing. Robin Wright's line in the trailer about if you tell the people that the wall doesn't exist, you've bought a war, is related specifically to that. So Kay is dispatched to find and retire this born replicant. At some point, he begins to think that he may be the born replicant because of a memory that he has involving a wooden horse. Wallace, who is played by Jared Leto, has a replicant of his own named Love, who is played by Sylvia Hoax, I guess is the way that's pronounced.
Hex, maybe.
It's H-O-E-K-S.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, she's
she
Danish.
She is fan-fucking-tastic, okay. By the way.
Yes, she is.
And
she is amazing.
So she is at once trying to aid and take back, or not take back, aid and obstruct the investigation because Wallace wants to find this replicant because his whole thing is, he can't make them fast enough, or he can't make enough of them to really propel us into the stars like he would want. But if replicants are able to breed, then they can make their own new slave class, and it'll be great. He has the chilling line, humanity has lost its taste for slavery, which, Jesus. Controversial opinion, Jared Leto is really good in this movie.
Oh.
Yeah, all right. Let's move on before... So Kay finds Deckard, still played by Harrison Ford. Love finds them both and takes Deckard hostage because Wallace thinks that Deckard will know where the baby replicant is. And then what happens at the end? My brain is breaking down. Yeah, so Kay is found by an underground group of replicants who ask him to go kill Deckard so that he can't tell him nothing. Instead, Kay, who now knows who the replicant child is, goes and saves Deckard and brings him to see the very same woman who is a memory creation expert that he went to earlier in the film.
Even though at this point in the film, Kay most definitely knows that Deckard knows nothing about the location of the child because he wasn't even there to see it be born, and he doesn't even know the gender of the child.
Yeah.
So, you know, he could have easily just been like, nah, that dude's on his own. But, and you know, mainly because maybe he punched me a bunch of times.
There's a line in the movie that like dying for a cause may be the most human thing that one can do. And so that happens. And yeah, there's a lot of other interesting stuff that I kind of had to skip over. The fact that Kay's girlfriend is a hologram.
Mm-hmm. Her. Yep.
Yeah, her name is Joy, J-O-I. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to chew on, but that's the basics that we can kind of throw out there. And now we can begin to talk about some stuff. Let's get rid of the high level, the overarching one first. What did we think of the mystery and the way that its twists play out?
I really enjoyed the heartbreak on Kay's face when he realizes that he is not the prodigal child, I guess, in some ways, that he isn't actually a replica or isn't actually human.
Is a baby born of a replicant a human, or does this just mean that they're all humans? Yeah,
That's the question.
Yeah.
You know, this film, much like the original, gives a lot of questions and doesn't give a lot of answers, which I think is smart of it. I think the fact that they managed to weave in that replicants reproduce and like saying that phrase sounds really odd, but replicants producing is kind of like the last vestige of the Tyrell company, and like they're kind of Hail Mary of just being like, yeah, we're going to go bankrupt, but here we go. maybe they can reproduce on their own. And I think that like putting that notion into the original film works so seamlessly, as long as you try not to think like, wait, how do they reproduce? But also, like, are there like servos inside of them? No, they're, I guess they're flesh and blood in a lot of ways.
They're kind of like the Cylons in Battlestar Galactica, which I'm sure took a page out of the original Blade Runner. They're like, they're biologically similar to the point that in the original, you had to have that weird ass test to be able to tell what was
the Void Kampf.
Yes.
Yeah. So you wouldn't even like, you know, otherwise you would just like cut a sliver off of their arm and like peel it back and look and
or
see
just,
servos
like, fucking
and
hold
be
a
like
magnet up to them. Yeah. Like see if
sure, something. Yeah. See if they set off credit card machines. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. Can you walk through the airport? It's the same thing with Westworld, you know, the fact that like they used to be mechanical servos, but then they figured out that like it was actually cheaper just to biologically engineer actual flesh and blood, quote unquote, humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because it touches on those things and it manages to plant that seed into the original film that like flawlessly works, because there's nothing in the original film that has any way to like speak against this idea. And so as a sequel kind of nugget germ of an idea, it's kind of like elegantly beautiful in a lot of ways. It's just like, oh, well, like I can't say that doesn't make sense, because I, you know, in a lot of ways, and I can't remember her, what is the woman, Rachel, you know, Rachel is kind of a unique replicant for Ford's character to kind of come across. And, you know, she was obviously specifically designed, and, you know, this film kind of posits that she was not just specifically designed. She was specifically designed potentially so that Deckard would fall in love with her. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of that stuff is really interesting. And I agree, Brian. I actually like Jared Leto in this film, although his character itself doesn't do him a lot of favors. I think he's good. I don't necessarily enjoy his dialogue necessarily. And that, again, that has nothing to do with him. That is it seems like it's a flourish of Villeneuve just having someone just rattle off a lot of philosophy and just like
biblical references.
Yeah,
to me it felt like all of these fucking assholes in Silicon Valley who talk about making the world a better place and disrupting the paradigm. Like, we're gonna make a vending machine to get rid of bodegas, and it's like, you fucking idiot, like just shut up and go make another Uber.
Yes.
I couldn't get past his like egomaniacal delivery to even like try to find some I found him so distracting every time he was on screen. And to be fair, he's in the movie for 10 minutes. So, yeah, so it's not a huge strike against the movie. I think it is interesting that you guys are talking about, you know, the way that some of these turns do feel so elegant and they do feel organic. And like, I definitely agree. But I think I also, I guess one thing we haven't particularly gotten into is that the interesting thing about this is, you know, it kind of pulls a gentle rug pulling in the third act, you know, as we find out that the journey that this character went through that Ryan Gosling's character, Kay, went through is a little bit, I mean, narratively, it doesn't necessarily matter. It has its own, you know, emotional satisfaction. But I think that is where when I'm speaking specifically about the ways that this reminds me of his other movies, is how he kind of intellectual, emotional, kind of into the same thing. And he did that in Arrival. He did that in Sicario and Prisoners. And I think it's – the thing is that I often find it clever, but I have trouble feeling like, even though I went through that journey, that it was really necessary to spend that much time. And I think that is where it starts to lose me with some of these plot points, is that as much as everything is kind of in its right place, and even the ways that this kind of betters even, you know, this post Force Awakens nostalgic filmmaking, in the sense of the way it plays with Rachel, you know, Rachel's body and things like that. Like, it is willing to, you know, both bow to the past, but also, you know, create. And that is all interesting, like, on its own, but it just also gets very, very messy to me, which is weird to say about a movie that seems like so carefully planned out. So I think that is just honestly like my thing with this director that isn't going to go away, and why I'm partly like, it's not really a problem with the script, because this is what it's supposed to yeah. be.
One of the things that I've tended to like about his films is how big they are, but how small they become.
Sure.
So in this movie, there's a shit ton of stuff that could, like, a lesser movie would like end with like the Wallace Corporation being exposed.
Sure.
And
dying.
Right, or the replicant, the replicants. Are you a replicant or a replicant?
tomato, tomato.
What do you call a replicant philosopher? A replicant. So anyway, it would have ended with like the replicants rising up from their sewer lair and like taking over the world or some other nonsense. But instead, this movie ends with a man being reunited with his daughter, because whether anyone involved is a human, you know, because is it landed on whether Deckard is a human or not?
Yes, it's so very much implied. Yeah, it's very much implied that he's obviously human.
Okay, yeah. Just making sure, because like I said, I saw who knows what version of this movie, and I don't know what ones say.
Wait, I implied I thought he wasn't.
Yeah, that was what I thought. I don't know.
No,
I think
Dave Bautista's line at some point is, they started making y'all to hunt us down. And so basically the implication there is that this new line of Blade Runners are all replicants,
right, but,
and they're basically replicants hunting replicants.
Right,
and
Deckard
was not the original replicant hunting replicant,
but he was saying they made like the new version of them, so like, isn't it possible that they also used to have the old version hunting them, you know?
This is kind of ambiguous, I guess, as I think about it a little bit.
I find it to be incredibly ambiguous, if only because Harrison Ford, like, there's like the one moment that I think was sort of maybe fan servicey in the movie, just based off of my dim recollection of having seen the original, was when Ryan Gosling asked whether or not the dog is real, and Harrison Ford says, why don't you ask him? And then later on in the movie, Harrison Ford says, I know what's real. And so, like, I'd say it's still up in the air. And that's a thing that is true.
Okay. Yeah. It says here, film sequel Blade Runner 2049 maintains ambiguity. So. Yeah.
Because I think that ambiguity is like necessary. Because like, maybe it's that a human and a replicant have to interbreed to make a whatever you would call a human replicant baby. Maybe just a baby. Or if the replicants can breed on their own, which is what Wallace seems to be looking for. I don't know. And so I love the fact that the movie doesn't answer that and doesn't end with like the big showdown that one might be expecting. Because in the end, And this is, again, something that so many goddamn movies don't get. It's a story about humanity that ends on a human note. It doesn't shoehorn it in at the end of a giant action scene, because even the action scene that does come before it is very intimate and small. It's the point. It's the climax. That's the win moment. Like, when Deckard walks in and sees that girl in that barometric chamber, like, that's what everything has been moving towards. It may have begun on a large scale, trying to, like, find the child to bring her down. But what it ends with is a man being reunited with the daughter that he loved but had to leave for her own safety.
But I think that's the thing for me, is that it spends so much time building and giving this impression that this movie can go literally anywhere. I kind of had this with Arrival, too. So when it does go back to those emotional moments, which in some cases work for me and in other times I find kind of corny and unearned, but like when it does go to that, I feel like I'm being let down and misdirected. But it is very much his MO at this point. Like I'm literally thinking of like the five films I've seen from him, and they all have this.
That spider at the end of Enemy.
but I guess that is what feels weird about some of these, you know, some of the ambiguities here, is that it is still kind of, even as it's kind of expanding the way that it's looking at some of these, you know, time-worn questions, I still found the conclusions and the ways they went about them to still just kind of be souped up versions of that same thing. I am bothered by the way that this world does. What I love about the original, I think I already mentioned this, is that like at any moment, I honestly feel like the camera could keep panning. It doesn't feel like a set to me at any point. And 2049 does feel oddly empty to me in terms of at least characters, in terms of like everyone has this very specific place, but I don't get a sense of like an economy or like a culture. Like I see people who are in very specific places for certain points in this movie. And like that also extends to, I guess, social and political things to me. I do have some weird feelings about the way that the female characters are, you know, handled in this, which, I mean, I guess we can get into more specifically because there's actually quite a few. But I guess that's just what I want to figure out a little bit more from you guys about what specifically felt new to you. I know it's a very broad question here, but I'm just I'm kind of curious what the richest parts of, you know, this exploration were to you, because for a lot of this stuff, it did just feel like a dignified, but also like a very conservative reimagining of a lot of these ideas that have been like explored in sci-fi. And that's what I guess, like,
when you can say conservative, do you mean like politically or just not
political. Yeah. Okay. I just mean, not dated. I'm sorry. The status quo, I guess.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. Well, for me, there are two things that I find interesting about this. So like there's all this talk about how Kay's particular line doesn't have like the ability to lie and can't do certain things out of their protocol. And he breaks that once he starts to believe that he is the child that they are looking for. And I think that it's interesting that he ends up not being, because not only is it kind of a subversion of what you're expecting, you know, he's not important. He is just a foot soldier and an engineered foot soldier. But the fact that he believes that his memory is real and that means that he has been born makes him throw off like these interior shackles of his, and it gives him a sense of it. And so like, even though it ends up not being the case, he still acts differently. And it's this interesting statement of, like, sometimes just the belief that you are human is enough to make you that way. It's
Isn't it interesting that they have these baseline tests that they go through every single time they come back from the field to make sure, and they have all these internal protocols set up that basically if you don't pass baseline, like the whole fucking place locks down and you are going to stay there. Either immediately be terminated because you're not at baseline, or, you know, basically hold on, let's wait for 24 hours. But more than likely, like, his situation would have been, you go sit in the cell for 24 hours and think about what you've done. And then let's come back and let's try again with this baseline test, which, all of that just kind of builds on this idea that, yes, they obey, and yes, they are in some ways supposed to be these perfect kind of mindless machines. But also, we've already dabbled in that, and we've seen that some of these replicants are not going to obey. So we're going to have all these protocols maybe set up just in case.
Well, what's more interesting for me is that we open the movie and he has a very violent confrontation. I'm really starting to lose it. He has a violent confrontation, and, like, you would think that, you know, they call it like a post-traumatic stress baseline something. So, like, basically what they're expecting is that the violence and the act of, like, murdering your own kind will be the thing that breaks you. But for him, it's not. Like, he was so fine after he had that violent encounter and murdered that guy. But what breaks him is the belief that he may be the one, be, like, different, be this born thing. And so that, to me, was really interesting, because it's like, obviously they expect the violence to break you from your normal baseline, but what they don't expect is, like, hope and curiosity and just the belief that you are different to do it, which he does in this. And there's something else. I was also going to say, like, just his relationship with his
girlfriend,
his hologram. I didn't want to say part of the movie. And then I didn't want to say Joy, because that sounds like a self-help book. But yeah, his whole relationship with her is super weird, because there's a whole other story to be wrought out of just that relationship. Like, we've seen that movie. It's called Her. But in this case, the man is also not a human, and he, you know, if he is fractions removed from humanity, how far removed is she from humanity? And, like, there's that billboard at the end that says, like, everything that you want to see, feel, and hear. But, like, she became, like, when they're leaving that apartment and she's like, look, you know, what you got to do is you got to completely download me to your emanator and then break the mainframe on your wall.
Break the radio, basically.
Yeah, and then snap the radio so that the antenna, so that, like, they can't access. And he's like, okay, but if I do that, then if something happens to the emanator, then you die. And she's like, just like a real girl. Like, I feel like that's not in the programming. Like, I feel like that wouldn't be, like, something that, your iPod, if you say Siri, like, I'm really upset, Siri doesn't say, why don't you throw me into a brick wall and see if that helps.
Sure. and all of this stuff is, it goes back to the simple idea of, like, the Turing test. And, you know, is this program acting the way it's supposed to, or is it kind of going on its own? And these are all the questions that Ex Machina brings up, that Her brings up, that this film kind of dabbles in just a little bit. And that's how big and broad this film is that it wants to dabble in it, and it does a decent job of, like planting that germ, but then it's got so much other bigger things to kind of fry that it's like, we're not really gonna dive into this, but this is really neat, right, guys? You know, and, you know, maybe at the end of the film they should have been like, hey, if you enjoyed that Joy sequence, seek out Ex Machina and Her and, you know, all these other films, like, for a little bit more of a exploration,
because I think that the ambiguity is part of it. Like, obviously,
I enjoy it too.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's that moment when, like, she's about to get stepped on, and she, like, leans down and tells him that she loves him. Like, at that moment, if you're just a program who's there to tell him whatever he wants to hear, like, if you're about to be destroyed, I feel like you wouldn't really care anymore. Like, I don't know how deep the programming would go that would be the last thing. But then, you know, a lot of people in their last moments will call up a loved one to say, I love you, I'm about to die. And so, like, how it is that question of, like, how close. But then even weirder is the fact that, again, he is not a real boy. Like, he is a replicant.
Yeah, well,
so,
like, there's references to Pinocchio. I believe the tone that is brought up or every time the Wallace Company, like, emulator thing dings, which I guess is him, like, being hailed by her. I'm not sure what's going on there.
Yeah, it's a little bit
but weird. And that apparently that tone is Peter and the Wolf.
Yes, it is.
I believe.
Yeah.
And so, like, there's a lot of, like, little details that if you're not, like, intimately familiar with a lot of this stuff, you won't really pick up on. And I think that's going to be really interesting to see all of the stuff that he kind of wove into the film. I was listening to a podcast and they were saying that this may compete with Mother in the amount of, like, biblical references, which I only recognized, like, two or three. And I was just like, what? Okay.
Everything Leto says.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
well,
he's
in the film again for like 10 minutes though. So,
yeah,
you know, I can't believe that they were like, yeah, this competes with Mother with the amount of biblical references. I was like, a whole movie versus 10 minutes. I was like, what is going on? Okay. And I guess then, I need to watch this again.
Yeah. And then I guess the final thing I say is just like, I do like how much, like, it's such an epic movie, and yet, like, everything that happens is so small. Like, he goes to that orphanage, and mm-hmm. we, like, really take time to understand the economy that has created this place and allows it to flourish. And we see, like, even in this future, like, there's still the margins, and they're still populated by the people you would expect them to be.
You know, this...
Well, Michael had asked us this, so let's give Michael a reaction moment to what we said.
I guess I see where you guys are coming from, and I definitely, as you mentioned, you know, all of these details, whether it is those small eccentricities, like, you know, Peter and the wolf playing with that tone, or, you know, just these little things about the way that it is constantly interrogating, you know, Gosling's, like, state. And I really do like the joy stuff. That is that, along with the daughter played by Carla Yuri. Those are my favorite parts of the film, I think, because they're the parts that get away from kind of this straight ahead. These noir trappings. But, like, I think the thing is, too, is that from moment to moment, what I really want in noir, honestly, more than even a good mystery, is a charismatic gumshoe and some rat-a-tat really memorable dialogue. And that wasn't quite there for me, you know, other than a bizarre gorgonzola cheese joke towards the end. I do just feel like this is at once, like, so cluttered and, like, so ambitiously cluttered, but also, like, just doesn't give me a lot, or it gives me a lot, I should say, a moment to moment, but not by the end. I'm still just thinking about how much the journey how disconnected they felt, you know, whether it be something like the orphanage that he goes to, which, again, like, from a composition aspect, like, this huge a row of, you know, children,
orphans,
orphan, like, slave workers, like, something out of, you know, King Vidor's the crowd, like that is incredible, but it also just makes me feel even more like this movie is just trying to do to at once again be this epic procedural, to be this to have this sidelined, you know, AI and interrogation, to also be this discussion of memory and how much that defines what even being a person means. Like that stuff is all there, and it's ambitious, but all of it just feels like it's just dipping its toe. But then oddly, I don't necessarily want like a longer cut of this, because like from moment to moment, I just find it kind of exhausting. Like, and it's just a very strange reaction to have, to have like admiration for all of these things, but just to feel such a distance to it.
Well, like you've already mentioned that the center line of this film, and I think a lot of people are probably in a similar boat with you, is if you do not connect with Gosling's kind of journey and his story arc, most of this movie is predicated and built around that story arc, and it's his discovery and it's his journey. And once that, you called it pulling the rug out from the audience, for me, I didn't feel like that at all. I felt like that was his journey, and I benefited from having seen him go through that journey, because he's a unique perspective that was able to both be the thing and not be the thing at the same time. Yeah. And so I enjoyed that aspect, but I think what you're kind of pushing back against is all of these things that just felt like dominoes to a ultimate finale that you were like, no, I didn't. Like, if he's not going to be the prodigal son, then I reject everything attached to that, which is an hour and a half to 2 hours of this movie, basically. Yeah. It's his journey of like, sure, discovering that. So I think that's kind of your issue with like attaching yourself to this film and looking at all these pieces. I think you would have a lot more appreciation of it if at the center of it, which of course, you know, a lot of these movies are built on like one single thing that kind of carries the momentum and the movie forward. You, sure, were like, no, I didn't appreciate that journey because it felt like a rug pulling. And for me and Brian, obviously it was like, no, we enjoyed that because we didn't get that ultimate catharsis of him being that person, and yet we still watched him go through that journey.
But I think the weird thing about it is that, you know, I've talked a lot about The Return on the podcast, on this podcast, but to speak broadly, the Return is also interested in constantly Twin Peaks, The Return, yes, is interested in pushing back on this idea of heroes and expectations and things like that. But I think the other fundamental disconnect with this director for me is at once that it does feel so put together, that moment where he does turn and, you know, retroactively make it a fundamental part of the movie. Like, again, something he does over and over is that it feels organic in weirdly a way that then feels strained to me. And I recognize that that's a contradiction in itself. A
little bit.
But I know. But there's, I think I want to say that, like, it's not only that. Like, I've liked plenty of films that have then, you know, changed direction to say, no, and this Wait, isn't
you,
really
you
a
broke
puzzle
up there for a second. Could you, sure, could you, sure, say it again?
I've liked plenty of other films where they have not necessarily pulled the rug, but at least pivoted or reconfigured what I previously knew. I mean, noir does this all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like it's a primary tenet of it when you realize that, like, sure, oh, the thing that you thought was over is actually connected to this other thing that you didn't even know you were looking into.
Sure. Chinatown.
Sure. Yeah, but like, I see what you're saying, but I don't want to say that that structure is what I fundamentally push back. It's for whatever reason how he does it. And I
you just for don't like Denny reason, V.
I can't articulate. Well, I the one movie I seem to really like from him was Sicario, and now I'm questioning even that.
Oh no. I mean, for me I've you know, I was like upset for a moment for this movie to be like, yep, we're following the guy, because like sometimes I hate when a movie follows the guy, like the most important person in the world.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, like we spend the entire goddamn Harry Potter movie series
following the most Harry boring Potter. Character.
What was that?
Following the most boring character.
Yeah, because he's and you're just like, well, obviously, you know, the eye of the narrative has chosen him because he's the chosen one and all this other stuff. And then like, I just love it. Like, I love the fact that at the end of this movie, they're like, oh no, like you may have thought that, but you're not, like, yep. Sorry. But then like the thing is like, you the belief that you were has brought you to this point. And now what are you going to do with the knowledge that you're not? Like, you're obviously, are you going to allow the fact that someone has told you that, you know, you're not the one who was born, like you're not the prince who was promised or whatever, to like make you lose all of the stuff that you've done and the skills and the knowledge that you've gained? Or are you going to go out and do something else that is equally as important? And in this case, the thing that's equally as important is just getting a dad and his daughter back together.
I think one thing for Denny's films that I really kind of – and I touched on this when we talked about Arrival, but his like insistence on filming the – almost the mundane in ways that are so just involving and thrilling. There's a sequence in Sicario where they're basically driving rapidly through the Mexican streets, which ultimately doesn't actually end up doing anything. But all of that buildup, you see so much of it, and it's just spent so much screen time doing all of these mundane things. And their Arrival, it's her coming back from the initial interaction and just shaking and shivering. And in this film, I think it's that sequence, the baseline test that goes on and gets and almost seems to get louder and louder.
Yeah,
and
my wife intense. Said that she nearly had an anxiety attack during that.
Yeah, like all of these things he spins, you know, that sequence probably maybe in real time lasts all of 90 seconds maybe, but it feels like it lasts 5 minutes because you're just there in the room with him. Nothing else is going on. They don't switch perspectives. It's kind of this over the shoulder view of him, and it's just him interacting with this voice, this like, you know, what is it called when the voice is not actually there, this like disconnected. Yeah, disembodied voice that's just like telling him to repeat all these lines. And it's almost infuriating the way it's kind of just monotonous. And like, those are the sequences for these kind of films that stick with me for however long I get away from them. Like, I will always remember that interrogation sequence. Like,
yeah.
It's just going to be burned in my mind.
So do we have any final thoughts to dole out before we say goodbye?
Sure. I do want to touch on the action in this film, which I don't think has gotten enough praise. Mm-hmm. Because obviously I think people are so enraptured with the way the film actually looks. And whether they are connecting with it or not. And, you know, the fact that it's 2 hours and 45 minutes or whatever the runtime is. And I think everybody's like, oh yeah. And then it's got some action beats. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. Hold on. Like these action beats, just in terms of like raw numbers of minutes on screen, I was thrilled throughout all of them. I enjoyed them so much. I love the guns that they use, and I know it's kind of a callback from the original, but this one seems to, I guess maybe, you know, it's cheap to say, but it maybe has a little bit more punchiness. I'm not sure, but I'm fascinated by something that
apparently can blow holes in people, but also doesn't have any recoil. And it's like, whoa, okay,
yeah.
This is interesting. And it makes that much noise. Like, I could see if it didn't have recoil, if it didn't make that much noise, but this thing makes a lot of noise.
It appears to actually have a projectile. What I'll say about the action is I love, again, this movie kind of going against what you'd expect from a big spectacle film. Like, people in the background bleed. Like, there's a mortar attack, mm-hmm. basically, and you see a guy get thrown into the air, and there is blood spurting from his severed leg. Like, I like the fact that, you know, to that extent, this movie has a humanist approach so that even the people in the background are allowed to bleed.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I will mention one other thing that I really enjoy about this film and this particular idea of, you know, having androids and female androids in that way, even though they're in this film, it plays with it. But, you know, in most of the films, they're not gendered specifically for any real purpose except for just the outer appearance. But I love the idea that, like, Love basically enters Gosling's apartment and she just, like, beats down the door, like in just this way of, like, how did she open it? And then you see, like, the locking mechanism on the floor in front of her, and you're just like, oh yeah, she just pushed the damn thing open. She does that again when she, I believe, enters the detectives, the lieutenant's quarters as well. Mm-hmm. And she does this over and over again. And I really enjoy the idea that, like, this female basically, you know, and it's kind of a cheap way, but it is kind of in the Wonder Woman mold of just, like, yeah, she's just a badass. And, like, she would, like, fucking crush, like, most of the humans because, you know, she happens to be an android as well.
I mean, she does crush a number of humans in this movie.
Yes, she does.
One of them, two of them, literally.
Yeah, it is brutal, and I love that so much of her. Hoax? I don't even know how to say her name. I'm going to have to figure that out.
Sylvia Hoax?
Yeah, she's fantastic. Like, I love her presence in this film, and I love that she kind of has this internal thing of, like, one-upping Gosling's K, because at the end, like, she raises her hand in triumph and is like, I'm the best. And then she's like, and now I'm going to go kill Deckard. And you're just like, what is this android? Like, it is almost as demented as the original Roy Batty in the original Blade Runner. But the other thing is that she kind of rebels against her own maker as well. She cries and she lies, and she even tells someone that she's going to lie to her maker. So, like, all of this stuff is all kind of wrapped in, like, she's another special character, you know?
Yeah, and that's why she has kind of an unspoken rivalry with Gosling's character.
What I will say about those action sequences too is I think there's some it's not only the understanding of, like, the carnage, but I think there is something a real sense of emotional in how those fight scenes, especially. I mean the opening scene with Batista, I think is really excellent in just a sense of real, like, intention in every punch. Like, it's not a sense of, like, a flurry of punches. It's two men, like, grappling.
Yeah.
And every punch is, like, you know, a punch to his skull. Like, it's, you know, it's like Roddy Piper and
Jesus. And, are you talking about They Live?
Oh, yeah.
Oh my god.
But then even more than that, I'm thinking also of the scene where they're in Vegas, and a missile's coming. Is about to hit this car that they're running towards, and Gosling, like, makes a concerted effort to, like, pull back Harrison Ford's character in, like, this kind of emotional thing that, like, it's you know, he also thinks it's his father, but just, it's like, I do think that he understands action and understands, like, a certain, like, operatic aspect.
And I think Sicario, like, definitely, you know, your favorite, Michael, proved that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think the one thing I guess I'll say about the women in this is, you know, I already said that I really like Joy, Ana de Armas, I think, is the actress. But I think the thing about these women characters is I was just kind of reminded how much I wanted their perspective. Those moments when we did go to, you know, Sylvia de Hoax, who does kind of get her own moments, even where Ryan Gosling, you know, isn't in the scene, which is nice. And I did think she, but I a lot of times I felt like these performances were elevating a little bit, a little bit of underwritten characters. I mean, in the case of Mackenzie Davis, who's a, you know, really fantastic actress. I mean, she is, it's her performance that really makes, you know, a prostitute role something bigger. And granted, she is then later revealed to be something that's like 5 minutes of the movie. But there is just a weird sense that while there are like at least five main, you know, women parts, I also felt like they didn't really have a big role in the film. And that made me feel even weirder when I thought about
that is
the commodification, how, but also seems to provide like kind of a one dimensional, you know, like male gaze version of it. I am not the one who came up with this, but someone's already pointed out how there are not male Joys, for instance. There's not even any sense that there is a like equal sense of desire there. And I think that some of these characters, while the actresses like embody them with something more than their place in the story, I also ultimately felt like they were very much like playing a role and less had, you know, interiority beyond it.
Before
I'm
Brian
so upset
jumps
that you've brought this up right now, yeah, because I am about to die, and this is something we could talk about for like an hour.
All right.
Before Brian jumps in real quick, say just a pretty 100% rebuttal against what you just said. How often do we see male prostitutes in films? Just think about that.
We don't, but don't Bill, that's kind of
so.
Different. Wait. But the point is that they make this a big part of the film. Like, it's not a small thing. Like, if that's the thing, we're talking about science fiction, and we're still running into the same failure of imagination. Like, it's not just about like representation, although that's annoying, but it's literally about a sense that like that takes me out of the world. That reminds me that I'm getting a very myopic vision beyond the fact that I'm following a character who I don't really feel a connection with. Like it's those things that kind of feel all the more familiar to me beyond the fact that I don't really think this deals with old themes in new ways to the same extent you guys do. Like, well, I recognize that that's a regular Hollywood problem. Like, of course, sexism is a continuing problem, but I also think when a blockbuster spends this much time and it even has a sequence where, you know, his AI girlfriend, you know, that they have sex, but like that is something that like is a trademark of course of like dystopia, but also feels weirdly plain.
I'm gonna fight through my blinding headache to mount a defense. There is a scene we're introduced to Love as she is telling a female executive that she doesn't need workers who are very smart. So she doesn't need any kind of empathy or stuff. And then she tries to upsell her some sex robots.
Mm-hmm.
With the implication being that those would be male sex robots. Like,
yes.
So that's there. Now, as for Joy, I don't know. It's possible that when you first get Joy, you can choose a gender. But the only instances of us seeing Joy are her interactions with Ryan Gosling, who clearly has an interest in women. And so, you know, maybe there's a graphic novel somewhere out there where a female android falls in love with a Joe instead of a Joy. I mean, it's possible. I understand what you're saying. And I think that some of that has to do with the fact that, like I said earlier, this movie is building off the future that was envisioned in the 80s. And so it's possible that in the extrapolation of the first Blade Runner, you know, sexism and the denial of female pursuits of pleasure in that kind of way were like baked in. And maybe the statement that the movie is making is that it's still happening. But I don't know. Like, I wonder if there was a conversation where they talked about that. But I'm not sure. But to say that, like, the female characters in this movie lack interiority, I think is, like, either underselling or woefully misunderstanding almost all of them. I mean, there's a character whose entire job is to externalize her interiority. And she is, in the end of the movie, the most important person on the planet. Like, she goes through she's the most empathetic, giving person, and she's the person who is locked away from the world. Like, she creates these memories, and she's just filled with care for the androids, the people who people literally still feel cool standing in a hallway and saying, like, fuck you, skin job, to. And she says, your lives are so hard, if I can give you some nice memories to retreat to, I want to do that. But like that's most characters in movies are not given that much thought. Like, that is a woman who you can tell is born of her circumstances and has decided to make the best of it with a kind of interior strength that most people wouldn't possess. And then you have Robin Wright's character, who is, you know, she's the chief. She's the give me your gun and your badge. Like, but she still has this level of care. Like, she comes over to his apartment and has this long conversation with him. And during that conversation is, like, basically trying to, like, forge a human connection with this thing that she knows isn't human. And I don't know, like, and then you've got love, there's not enough good things to be said about love. And, like, we all talked about how she, like, cries, and she obviously has this competition in her. She wants no one else to succeed, Daniel Plainview. And, and so I don't know, like, For anyone to say that the female characters are half-baked or underthought out, like, you know, Ryan Gosling's character, it doesn't really have much anyway. Like, he's got literally, a single childhood memory that just drives him to say, like, Kay is going to protect what's his. Which he does, until the point that he doesn't. Because suddenly, being the one who was born isn't his anymore, but he's still going to try to protect it and give it to the person who it belongs to. And I honestly don't think I could talk anymore. I'm losing my voice, and I can't keep my eyes open.
Okay. So, yeah.
So, I don't know, Michael. Did any of that reach you, or is that stuff you'd all considered and you've written off?
No, I think the Robin Wright thing is something I would agree with. I recognize what you're saying about the person who creates memories, but I think it's also telling that this character has to exist in exile. So her life literally is that room. And I understand that's how she's written, but I think it is something that I don't think, for instance, Mackenzie Davis's character, I don't have a sense that she exists beyond being a prostitute and being a part of this, like, protest movement. Like, I just
is that okay?
I guess so, I mean,
about the guys who were working in the lab, like the poor guy exactly who gets his brain punched in.
here's the question, is whether the perspective of a male antagonist or protagonist in this film is the reason you start to question whether these females have any kind of interior motivations and things like that, or does a film have to have their one-on-one perspective fully shown and fully realized before that no longer becomes an argument. And I think for a film that is 2 hours and 45 minutes, we get a lot of females on the screen, and we get a lot of them doing what they want to do, not necessarily what they are commanded to do. And even when they are commanded to do what they are commanded to do, sometimes they even rebel against that in tiny little ways.
The memory girl openly says, like, we're not allowed to give real memories, and then but mm-hmm. he's got her real memory, so she has yes. rebelled against that statement because that's an important memory. The other thing I'll say is I honestly believe that there are more female characters than male characters in this movie, and I don't have the time or the mental acuity to run through it right now in my head because, like I said, I can't even keep my eyes open because the lights in this room are hurting my brain. But I would say if you cut Ryan Gosling out and just played all the other pieces in the movie, you would come out with like double the amount of screen time for women, because the only other male characters I can think of are the orphanage dude and Wallace. And like, if you want to talk about if you want to talk about a character that is not doing anything when the camera's not on him, sure. like, is that asshole just sitting in the dark with his like flying things, like listening to the water?
Like, well, he's the fucking worst, so I don't really have anything to say about
like,
him.
that's like an underwritten character. Like, Mackenzie Davis
yes.
has like she even just giving her that moment with the tree and then the horse and saying like, this came from a tree. It's like, that is more than Wallace gets, because Wallace is just an asshole. And so, yeah, I don't know. I feel like, you know, just because we have a character of one gender on the screen and then like they're underwritten, or they don't have that much to do in the narrative. Like, that shit happens all the time. The poor guy gets his fucking brain punched in and dies. And like, we didn't learn anything about him, but no one's going to say that he was an underwritten character because he served his purpose in the story. And sometimes that's just what you're there to do.
My last thing is, my critique is not only about representation. It's about feeling like that world starts to fall apart for me. That's what it about. It is about, when I mention that, that's one aspect of it. When I see how carefully detailed this world is, but then how much these people feel like plot devices or don't feel like they exist beyond their moment on the screen. I'm not trying to get into political conversations of sexism in Hollywood.
I thought that's what you brought it up. I mean, you mentioned sexism.
That was the veil under which you rolled it in.
That is not at all. You can go back, but that's not at all what I said.
Well, I am suffering from a crazy sinus-induced migraine, so maybe I misheard. But I remember that one of your main talking points was about the prostitutes all being female and not seeing any male joys.
But that is another aspect of why it falls apart, why this world starts to feel totally insular and myopic to me in a way that doesn't feel real like the old one felt.
Interesting. Well, I will I'll have to rewatch the old one, because I kind of purposely didn't rewatch the old one just because I was curious how this one would play on its own. Like, having seen it previously, I was like, I think I remember the bullet points, that'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't watch it because I didn't.
I'm losing
my ability to talk. We have to wrap this up.
If you guys want to talk about this more, we can on a round table or something. I'd be willing to talk about this. I don't want to lengthen this. I'm already feeling uncomfortable about Brian.
Yeah, I've been trying to end this podcast for like 20 minutes.
Yeah, sorry, man.
I want to mention one last thing.
Oh my god.
What?
If I die, my wife is going to fly to Dallas and kill you.
Okay. Take care of yourself, Brian. Do we think that Robin Wright's character was hitting on Kay?
I don't think she was hitting on him. I think she was reaching out to make a human connection with something that wasn't human, because they spent so much time together and she actually grown genuine affection for him and wanted a reason to believe that he was real.
Same. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought she was kind of hitting on him, but no. Okay. All right.
Nope. Cool. Okay. Glad I was able to answer that. What are we doing? Twitter.com/BrianJ. No, that's not right. Twitter.com/FilmStageShow. Facebook, The Film Stage Show. As always, we are brought to you by MUBI, the online streaming cinema. Going into October, MUBI always finds some really awesome old school horror films to bring up. Coming up soon, we have, David Cronenberg's Rabid, which is pretty damn awesome. We also have the original Night of the Living Dead. And that other movie I mentioned earlier. I can't remember it right now. MUBI is fucking awesome, and you can get a 30-day trial. Perfect right now, because if you do it, you'll get to watch it all through Halloween, which is when all their horror movies and stuff come out. And you can see what they've got in the pipeline for their bag of trick-or-treat tricks this year. All you gotta do is go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you get a free 30-day trial so that you can understand how cool Mubi is. Also, patreon.com/BrianJRowan. Nope. patreon.com/thefilmstageshow.
Brian, why don't we just record this later?
I'm gonna get through it. I'm gonna make it.
Okay.
The most human thing you can do is die for a cause, right? This is a cause. It's not a great one, but it's
I didn't know you were a suspected replicant.
Okay. I'm a borderline psychopath. If that doesn't make me almost a replicant, I don't know what does. So what was I gonna say? patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. Give us your money. Help us to afford better healthcare and to get better equipment and do even more shows. If you would like a show that's just me rambling when I have a high fever, we can maybe do that for you. Guys, it's been the realest. It's been Trill. Let's get out of here and tell the fine people at home where they can find us next time, between now and next time. And next time, we're probably going to be talking about Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Yeah.
The newest film from S. Craig Zahler, who is the writer-director of Bone Tomahawk, which was one of my top films of that year, I believe. Stars Vince Vaughn and Udo Kier, who is the best. Next week, we're going to be talking about that.
Don Johnson,
true. Between now and then... I'm going to die and then be reborn like Jesus Christ. All right, Michael, do the thing where you say where you are.
I'm on Twitter at @Snydell. Okay. And I hope Brian feels better.
I'm not. I'm never going to be okay again. Bill Graham, why don't you do the same thing that Michael just did?
@CableBFG on Twitter. And you can also find me on the Slack channel. Very curious about how our Patreon members react to this.
They're probably all going to give you a bunch of shit for not listening to the first 7 times that I said we have to go. But I'm glad
maybe
you're able to work that final discussion in. Michael, next time, write that down and make it the first thing you bring up.
Oh, great.
I blame you. I blame you for creating a compelling topic that we actually dove into, unlike Bill's Robin Wright hitting on K thing, which we were able to shut down pretty easily.
Damn.
So that's me. You can find me every day on Twitter praising Michael and insulting Bill, and the Slack channel for our Patreon donors, and my personal site, dearfilm.net, where I wrote an essay about endings in movies in relation to Gerald's Game, which we talked about last week. I don't think I'm going to write an essay about Blade Runner 2049. I feel like we've said everything that there is to say, maybe. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and tune in next week when we talk about Cell Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, let's play. Can you teach me to throw? I said, not today. I got a lot to do. He said, that's okay. And he walked away, but his smile never dimmed. It said, I'm gonna be.
Okay, I'm gonna go die now.
All right,
bye.
Bye.
Hold on, wait a second. Fuck, I turned off the wrong thing. I turned off the headphones and not the recorder.